Ada kind of gave up. Or did she? If she's at the dairy farm she wanted, I suppose it all worked out for her. Cedric put his arm around my shoulder, letting me lean against him. Once we're married and everything is stable, you can send word back to your grandmother. Let her know you're all right. Afternoon sunlight shone down on us through the branches of the great maple behind our backs. If I weren't feeling so melancholy about Grandmama, I could have thought of it as an idyllic setting. I just hope she can forgive me for...
There you two are!
Snapped a harsh voice. We both looked up to see Elias Carter, Warren's chief assistant in Haddison, striding toward us.
The party's getting packed up and nearly ready to move again. I should have known I'd find you two off here doing immoral things.
Eating lunch? I asked. Elias fixed me with a beady glare. He'd made it clear many times on this trip that he disapproved of us.
Don't be impertinent with me, Miss Bailey. How the governor ever found it in his magnanimous heart to forgive you and offer you this chance is beyond me. I wouldn't have, but then he's a great man. I am not.
That's certainly true, said Cedric, deadpan. Elias's brow furrowed, as he seemed to realize he'd inadvertently insulted himself. Before he could respond, we heard a scream coming from the direction of the main camp. Without a backward glance at us, Elias ran off toward it. We followed close behind. The first thing I saw was that the party hadn't been nearly ready to move again, as Elias had told us. There were signs all around that others had been in the middle of their lunches, too, but no one was eating now. Everyone was on their feet. Some people, particularly those with children, were rushing toward the back of the camp with their little ones. Others, mostly men, were stalking toward the front. Until now I hadn't realized how many weapons were in this caravan. Guns and knives abounded.
"What's going on?" I asked one woman.
"Ikori," she said. "Best hide with us." Cedric and I looked at each other in disbelief. "Ikori haven't been in Denim in nearly 2 years," he said. He put out an arm to stop me when I started to move forward. "You don't have to hide, but we probably shouldn't go bursting into the middle of this until we know what's going on.
I just want to see."
Cedric reluctantly moved through the crowd with me. He wasn't the type to try to tell me what I could or couldn't do, but I had a feeling that if there was any sign of danger, he'd toss me over his shoulder and carry me away kicking and screaming. We stopped near the edge of a group of would-be prospectors, all with guns drawn. It gave us a clear vantage down the dusty trail through the woods. There Warren and several other armed men stood in front of two men on horseback, who met every description of the Ikori I'd ever read or heard. Well, except for the part about them being bloodthirsty demons. Dress and styling aside, these two looked pretty human to me. One was an older man, late 50s perhaps, with a bushy red beard and a tunic of green plaid. He was the size of a bull, and despite his age, something told me he could hold his own against a younger man in a fight. Probably a dozen younger men. The rider beside him didn't look much older than Cedric. His bare, muscled chest was painted with designs of blue woad. A tartan in that same green plaid was draped over one shoulder and held with a copper pin. White blonde hair hanging loosely to his shoulders contrasted with his skin. He was the one Warren seemed focused on while speaking.
"And I told you, you have no business here. Ikori are not welcome on Denim lands, or any civilized Ospridian lands. Go back to the territories you were ceded."
"I would gladly do that," the blonde man replied, "if your people would stop trespassing onto our lands." There were two notable things about the way he spoke. One was that he was remarkably calm, given all the guns pointed at him. Second, his Ospridian was nearly perfect.
"No one wants your lands," said Warren, which seemed slightly inaccurate, given all that Osfrid and other countries across the sea had taken. "If anything, I've heard rumors of your people harassing our lands up north. Should that be true, you'll have real visitors in your lands in the form of our soldiers, a little more serious than these delusions you're prattling on about."
"The burned villages I've seen aren't delusions. We demand answers."
Warren scoffed.
"Forgive me if I don't really feel the two of you can make demands. There's a lot more of us than there are of you."
"Shoot 'em!" someone called from the crowd. "Shoot the savages!"
The Ikori man remained unfazed and never looked away from Warren. I'd hoped we wouldn't need shows of force to open a dialogue on protecting innocence. I think that's what civilized men do.
"Civilized?"
sneered Elias. Like Yor wants to talk. This civilized man is going to give you the chance to leave with your lives.
Warren's words suggested generosity, but his tone was pure ice.
Not far ahead is a northward trail that cuts through the corner of Denim and leads over to the Western Territories.
I'm sure you know it. I'm sure it's what you took to get here. Turn around right now and go back. If you move fast enough, you should be out of Denim by sunset. I'm going to leave a group of men to guard that trail's intersection and scout it out in the morning. If there's any sign that you are still in our lands, you will die.
Shoot him anyway! Someone yelled.
The Ikori murmured something to his companion. The bearded man scowled and answered back in their own language. The blonde man turned back to Warren.
We will take our conversation elsewhere. Thank you for your time.
The Ikori turned around on their horses, and I held my breath as several men held up their guns and aimed at the Ikori's backs. Warren noticed this too and held up a hand of warding. The Ikori horses quickly moved from a walk to a gallop and were soon out of range. The Ikori encounter was all anyone could talk about for the rest of the day. Opinions were understandably mixed. Plenty were in the shoot-'em camp. Others thought Warren's act of compassion only showed what a noble spirit he had.
It was all a bluff,
an older man told Cedric and me at dinner that night. He paused to turn his head and spit.
He had no other choice. If he'd killed him, there's always the chance of triggering another war. No one knows how touchy the Ikori are these days. And that whole nonsense about men guarding the trail is, well, nonsense. Ikori don't need trails. If they want to slip away and melt into the woods, they can.
I looked across the heads of the other settlers, off to where Warren sat on the opposite side of camp. He had a bigger group of admirers than usual, all lauding him on his masterful act of diplomacy. I'd thought it was well done myself, until I heard our companion's commentary. The Ikori were much more composed than I expected, I remarked. I'd be a lot more hostile if I'd been forced from my land.
Twice, the old man reminded us. Don't forget the heroes who threw them out of Osfrid in the first place. Good King Wilfred, Suttingham, Bentley, Rothford.
I tried not to wince at hearing my ancestor's name. The settlement of Osfrid had taken place so long ago that it was easy sometimes to forget that the savages Rupert had fought there were the ancestors of those who'd fled across the sea and made new lives for themselves in these lands. Or tried to, at least.
This place is so vast, I told Cedric later. Adori is 100 times the size of Osfrid. Shouldn't there be enough room for all of us this time?
He gazed around us. Nightfall was upon us, but we could still make out the enormous trees as they reached up to the stars. Greedy men never have enough room. I don't know what'll happen to the Ikori, or this land.
Osfrid was once this wild, too, and now it's clear-cut and parcelled.
He looked back down and slipped his arm around me.
I caught the scent of his vetiver, reassuring me not all civilization was lost. One thing I do know is that they've increased nighttime watches. You and I are going to have to go separate ways tonight.
Are you sure?
But even as I spoke, I knew he was right. I could already see patrols assembling.
I won't sleep nearly as well.
I'll actually sleep better, he muttered.
You don't like sleeping by me?
I like sleeping by you too much. I spend half the night thinking about, hey, I warned, there are children nearby. Cedric gave me a look of mock chastisement. What I was going to say is that I spend half the night thinking about when we're getting married. The places your mind goes. Someone should have sent you to finishing school.
Technically, you sent me to finishing school, so you've got no one to blame if you want me to behave differently.
He drew me in for a kiss.
Now why would I ever want that?
So there was no more shared sleep between us for the remainder of the trip. I missed it, achingly so, but I kept reminding myself this was all just another step along the path to our future. We would endure.
You and your young man didn't have a fight, did you?
Mistress Marshall asked me one day. We were both riding in the wagon, and I was wondering if I should be concerned that I no longer noticed the rattling.
Why do you think that?
She gave me a knowing look.
Just noticed you've been sleeping by our wagon again these last few days.
I felt a flush sweep over me.
Mistress Marshall, it's not anything like that. Nothing happened.
We were just sleeping together. I mean, like, actually sleeping. Then we decided it'd be best to stop after the watches increased.
Very sensible of you, she said.
I couldn't tell if she really believed me.
I mean it, I insisted. We've behaved, that is, well, exactly as we should. And we'll keep doing that.
Her smile was kind, despite a cracked tooth.
Perhaps, but you're very young, and I know how hot young blood can run. While you're under my roof, I'll make sure you're respectable and keeping with the virtues dictated by Euros. But when you're not under my roof... I couldn't meet her eyes.
Mistress Marshall, we intend to behave with the utmost decorum until we're married.
Intentions and actions rarely line up, and in the event your intentions go awry, I don't want you to get in trouble.
She handed me a small burlap bag with a spicy smell.
These are cinnamon thorn leaves. You know what these are for?
I gulped, and impossibly felt my blush heat up even more. Yes, ma'am. Our teachers at Blue Spring Manor, back in Osford, told us.
Well, that's good, she said. Saves us both from an embarrassing conversation.
I wasn't so sure about that. As it was, I really didn't think my mortification could get any worse at that moment. I tried to hand the bag back to her.
Thank you, but I really don't think I'll need these.
She refused the bag.
I've got plenty. They've kept me at 6 kids. If they keep you from having one before you're ready, it'll be well worth it.
I might have tried handing it back to her again, but then I heard a shout from farther up in the caravan. The Eastern Tributary! We're at the Eastern Tributary! Cheers sounded, and I looked back to Mistress Marshall. What does that mean?
It means, my dear, that we're about to cross into Haddison.
Chapter 23. Aside from the tributary itself, there was no ostensible difference between Haddison and the far reaches of Denham. We crossed the shallow water and continued on. Certainly the land had shifted from what we'd left in Cape Triumph and its outskirts. Vegetation had thinned out, and the peaks of a low mountain range grew clearer in the distance. The famous gold mines were located in the foothills of those mountains. The lowlands contained greener farmland, such as those the Marshalls claimed. We'd been traveling for just over a week when we arrived in White Rock, Haddison's capital city, such as it was. Excitement and a renewed sense of energy filled our party as we crossed into the town's limits. Had I seen it immediately after Cape Triumph, I would have been disappointed. But after days and days of trees, it felt as urban as Osfro. In reality, it was still a city in its early stages, with dusty tracks for roads, and at least half the businesses being run out of tents. As in Cape Triumph, a mix of people walked the streets, but there were no elite, well-to-do in this group. All belonged to the rough working class. There was one fairly large house noticeable on a hill in the distance, almost as nice as Wisteria Hollow. That's the governor's house, Warren said, riding up on his white horse. He dismounted effortlessly. Where I'll be staying. The words hung between us a moment, and I regarded the fine house with a moment of envy. Tamsin will be pleased, I said at last. He gave me a small smile.
I hope so.
In White Rock, a new sort of chaos ensued. This was the launching point for all the settlers. Some already had claims and plots assigned to them. They looked over maps and surveys, trying to determine where their lands were and how long it would take to get to them. Other settlers had come here blindly, carried along by a dream. They either solicited Warren's agents for land to buy or lease, or else they sought work among those more established. Residents of White Rock, seeing new blood, were eager to come and sell their wares. "I'm going out to my claim tonight," Cedric told me later. He'd been consulting a map with several of the men. "Ours are near each other, and we'll go together."
"I wish I could go too," I said.
"I saw where the Marshall place is. It's only about 2 hours' ride by horse."
"A regular horse or Lizzie?" I asked.
"Lizzie will do just fine. Let me see what shape the claim is in, and then I'll bring you by." Seeing my disappointment, he touched my face and drew me close. "It'll only be a day or two."
"I know.
I just hate parting again after everything that's happened."
"Cheer up. You lovebirds aren't parting for long," said Mistress Marshall, striding up to us. "And he's right. We are relatively close by. You'll get there soon enough, though you might not want to after you've stayed with us.
A wild claim isn't going to look nearly as comfortable as a well-to-do homestead.
Mr. Marshall had been out to Haddison a number of times, overseeing the construction of a house before bringing his wife and children. I wanted to be with Cedric, but a secret part of me was eager to sleep under a real roof in a real bed, especially since the sky was finally threatening rain. I also wondered what the odds were of taking a bath. There was so much dirt under my fingernails that I could no longer see the whites. Cedric and I parted with a kiss, and I watched him for as long as I could as I rode away in the Marshal's wagon. The scrappy little town grew smaller and smaller, and I caught one last sight of Cedric holding up his hand to me before all was lost in dusk's shadows. When we reached the homestead, night had fallen completely. I could just make out the house, a cabin built with crosswise logs. From the outside, it didn't look very big. As it turned out, it wasn't that big on the inside either. We had a large common room to be used for pretty much every household task, cooking, eating, sewing, entertaining, and so on. A tiny bedroom to the side was reserved for Mr. and Mistress Marshall. Upstairs, in a loft, a partition separated out two bedrooms, one for the girls and one for the boys. I was sharing a large bed with the three girls. I hoped none of them kicked. We spent the rest of the evening hauling in supplies before the rain came. Cape Triumph's sheltered position protected it from storms, but they could sometimes blow through to Haddison with a vengeance. Most of the journey so far had been about endurance, and this was my first real taste of hard labor. Mr. Marshall and a couple of the boys helped put the livestock in their barn. We finished just in time, and Mistress Marshall cooked us a pot of millet and dried meat for dinner over the hearth. We sat on a long bench at the table to eat. It wasn't comfortable, especially with my aching muscles, but it saved us from sitting on the hard-packed dirt floor. "It won't stay like that forever," Mistress Marshall said, pointing down. "We aren't savages. We'll soon have straw to cover it." When it came time to sleep, I picked a spider out of the bed and hoped there weren't any more. We blew out the candles and listened to the rain pound against the roof as we lay huddled together in the large bed. It turned out to be a steady downpour, not a fierce storm. The roof didn't leak, so it had that going for it, at least. Lying there in the dark, I remembered that I was a Countess of the Blood, a peeress of Ostrid. The anxiety I'd felt on my first day on the Haddison journey rose within me, and I tried to think of Cedric's words, that my difficulty came in simply adjusting to a situation I wasn't perfect at. It was comfort enough to help me fall asleep, though I had to wonder how anyone could feel like an expert at living in a cabin on the brink of civilization. Cedric didn't come the next day as he'd said he would, or the day after that. At first I was annoyed by the delay, but as more days added up I began to worry. The marshals told me all was probably fine, but the fear gnawed at me. I had plenty of time to think about all sorts of terrible possibilities because I was constantly engaged in manual activities that taxed my body more than my mind. My academic lessons wouldn't begin until the homestead was set up, and I didn't mind pulling my share for the marshals, but I was hopelessly underprepared. The skills I'd learned as a noblewoman were useless, and most of the glittering quartz lessons were as well. No marriage possibility had ever ended in a scenario like this. We'd practiced tasks that the mistress of a modest household, like Nicholas Addleton's, might need to supervise or even help out with if the other servants were busy. But there'd be no preparation for the chores that met me out here. I learned to milk cows and churn butter. I ground hard corn into fine grain. I dug in the earth to plant seeds for vegetables and herbs. I cooked batches of simple, hearty fare that was low on taste but could feed a large crowd. I made lye soap, which was pretty much my least favorite job of all. There was no party planning, no dancing, no sugared glass plates, no music in the conservatory, no conservatory. And my hands were, well, not what they once were. When Cedric finally showed, I was sweeping the cabin's earthen floor, something that seemed completely pointless to me. It mostly felt like I was moving dirt around. I'd been up since sunrise, and it was only one of many grubby chores I'd performed. I looked up to wipe my brow, startled to see Cedric standing in the doorway, regarding me with an astonished look. I let the broom drop to the floor and threw myself into his arms, nearly knocking him over in the process. He used the doorframe to steady himself and then wrapped me to him more closely. I rested a hand on his chest, taking in how real and solid he was.
You're not dead,
I breathed. He choked on a laugh. Nice to see you too, dear. I wanted to make a joke to hide my true feelings. I didn't want him to know how afraid I'd been these last few days, that I'd imagined terrible things happening to him, that I'd feared all these dreams we'd built would be lost. But as Cedric looked me over and his smile faded, I knew he could see it all in my eyes. I'm sorry, he said, softly.
Cedric, where have you been?
I tightened my hold on him and could see now that he was as dirty and worn as I was.
I've been so worried.
I know, I should have sent word, but there's been so much to do, more than I expected. You'll see soon enough.
We just finished breakfast, but you're welcome to some porridge,
Mistress Marshall said from behind me. I'd forgotten she was there. Her tone was friendly, but there was an edge to it. Cedric and I both understood. We quickly sprang apart. The aforementioned porridge had been one of the blandest things I'd ever had. Cedric had always been picky at Blue Spring Manor and Wisteria Hollow, insisting his eggs be poached and his pastries warmed. I figured he'd turn down such a mundane meal, but to my surprise he accepted and ate two bowls. When he finished, he asked the marshals if he could bring me to his claim.
I know she must have all sorts of things to do here, but I'd like to show her the land, he said. I'll return her by dinner time.
Certainly, said Mistress Marshall, and then you can stay and eat with us. Cedric looked immensely pleased by that. Another rainstorm had made for a cool morning, and I donned my suede pants and coat, along with the wide-brimmed hat. It was as much for practicality as to put on something clean. I tended to wear the same work dress each day, and the marshals took baths only on weekends.
"Don't you look like a proper frontier woman, ready to ride off and tame the wild?" Cedric said.
"Makes sense, since I'm a better rider than you," I walked up to Lizzie. "Are you sure she can carry two of us?"
"You tell me, horse mistress."
I patted the old mare's neck. "Sure she can. Just no hard gallops." We'd been too fresh out of Cape Triumph to even think about riding a horse together on our initial journey. Here, on the edge of civilization, the rules were more relaxed. Customs were dictated by expediency, and if we'd travel faster by horseback, so be it. He helped me up to the front of Lizzie, and then jumped up behind me, much more gracefully than other times I'd observed him while traveling. We followed the narrow, nearly overgrown trail through a wood of mixed trees. The morning soon warmed up, and I shrugged out of the coat. Our relationship might not be exactly forbidden anymore, but that didn't change the electric connection between us. My body still buzzed with awareness of his, and as we made the 2-hour journey, I realized I'd never had his arms around me for so long, aside from our nighttime getaways on the road to Haddison. The land sloped upward rapidly, but Lizzie plodded on. The claim was perched on a foothill that had been given the fanciful name of Silver Dove Mountain. A wide river flowed through it, and the view was breathtaking, revealing other mountains as well as the fertile lands we'd just ridden out of. I was so transfixed by it that it took me a moment to really take in the rest of the claim.
"Wasn't there supposed to be a house here?" I asked.
"There," he said, gesturing to a small rise of land. I followed him over and made out what I'd mistaken for a storage shed. It had a significant slant to it, and it was unclear to me if that was intentional or not. The outer planks were a mix of woods, some old and weathered, some new and yellow. The roof looked aged but sturdy, except for one corner that was covered by a tarp. Cedric followed my gaze to it. "I still have to work on that."
Have you been working on the rest of it?"
I asked delicately. I didn't want to offend him, but it was really hard to tell. "It's why I was so late. When I got here, this thing was barely standing. I spent that first rainy night on the ground, huddled under the tarp. I've made trips into town for supplies and did a lot of the repairs myself. The prospector on the next claim over helped me with some, too."
Cedric looked over the shack.
"I didn't want you to see it, or even this whole place, in such a state. There's so much work to do. But I knew I couldn't stay away any longer." I found his hand and laced my fingers with his.
"I'm glad you didn't.
And you can't be ashamed of any of this, not if we're going to share a life together." He lifted my hand and studied it. The skin was cracked and raw from the lye. Dirt was everywhere, especially under my nails. There was a long cut I didn't even remember getting. Releasing the hand, he sighed.
Hey now, don't sound so dejected,
I told him.
It's nothing some moisturizer and a little soap, real soap, not that cursed stuff Mistress Marshall made, won't fix. I'll be back to my same old beautiful self in no time.
He turned me to face him. The afternoon sun lit him up, turning his dark auburn hair to fire. You're already your same old beautiful self. Maybe even more so than when I first met you. I think about that day a lot, you know. I remember every detail. I remember that dress you wore. Blue satin with rosebuds on the sleeves. And every curl perfectly arranged. I'd never seen anything like you. Lady Whitmore, Countess of Rothford. He sighed again. And now look what I've brought you to. If I hadn't darkened your doorway that day, where would you be now? Certainly not in the middle of nowhere, scrubbing some farm wife's house while desperately hoping your heretic husband can scrape together enough money to buy us both out of suffocating contracts. You'd have been married in silk, on the arm of someone whose bloodline matched yours. You're still like nothing I've ever seen, and you're the first thing I think of when I wake up each morning. But sometimes, well, I'm just not sure if I've improved your life or made it worse. I looked him over. Like me, he was dirty and disarrayed, his workman's clothes a far cry from the brocade vest and amber pin. You saved my life, I told him, and I don't need silk. I pulled him toward me, and we met in a kiss. The world around me was golden. I was warmed by the sun, his embrace, and the joy building up within me. There was no dirt or fear or complication, only this perfect moment with him. Now, I said, show me around your house. His house consisted of one room. A battered tiny stove in the corner provided both heat and cooking, though he didn't have much in the way of food. There were two chairs and a table about the width of a bookshelf. His bed was a hay-stuffed mattress on the floor, which was packed dirt just like the Marshall's. I tapped my foot on it. I know how to sweep this, if you need help. He shook his head. This whole place needs help. Do you want to see the rest of the property? I can even show you the basics of panning. I haven't been able to do much with it while working on this place. I hesitated. I did want to jump in and start earning the money to pay back Warren, and desolate or not, this claim and its view were beautiful. I wouldn't have minded exploring them. Mostly I just want a bath, I blurted out. When he started laughing, I put my hands on my hips and attempted an affronted look. Hey, some of us haven't been able to sleep out in the rain. Apparently baths are only for Saturdays at the Marshall House. It was worth the teasing in his eyes to see the old genuine smile back. He caught my hand again. Come on. I think that can be arranged. Is there a luxury bathhouse on your property? I asked hopefully. There wasn't, but there was a small pool. More of a pond, really, not far from a bend in the Matthias River. It appeared to be fed by some underground source, which wasn't surprising, given the river's meandering and branching nature. A few trees grew around the pond, offering a little shade on the increasingly hot day. I know it's not what you're used to, Cedric said apologetically. But given the circumstances, I figured... Wait, what are you doing? What I was doing was stripping off my clothes. I didn't care that I couldn't see the bottom of the pond. I didn't care that I had no soap. I didn't care if the neighborly prospector came strolling by and saw, and I certainly didn't care if Cedric saw. I left my clothes in a pile on the thin grass and waded into the pond. The afternoon might be warm, but the water was still cool and welcome after days of grime and sweat. I didn't stop until the water was just below my shoulders, and then I dunked my head under in a feeble effort to clean my hair. When I emerged, I pushed the tangled mess back and looked around. Cedric still stood on the grass, his back to me. "What are you doing?" I asked. "Come in here." "Adelaide, you're perfectly respectable, I swear." "Is that a creative definition of respectable?" But he dared a peek back, looking relieved that I was mostly submerged. "Come in here," I said again. "You could use a bath too. Besides, didn't you see all this that day in the conservatory?" "Look, I'll even turn around." I did, and waited until I heard the sound of splashing as he too entered the water. "You know," he said, "you keep bringing that up, but I actually didn't see anything that day. I was so terrified that I pretty much looked everywhere but at you." I turned around and grinned, seeing him just a couple of feet from me. And here I thought I'd been feeding your imagination for months.
Oh, it's had plenty to feed on, don't you worry.
He dunked his head too, and then brought it back up, scrubbing at his hair with his hands.
For my last bath, back at Wisteria Hollow, I used lavender cream soap from Lorendy. If I'd had any idea what I'd be facing here, I would have smuggled it with me.
I'll be sure and pick some up for you the next time I'm in White Rock, Cedric said. I think they sell it between the jerky stand and the ammunition tent. I moved toward him, and he took a step back. Adelaide.
We can't kiss. I thought we established you can't see anything.
I can feel plenty. I stepped toward him again, and this time he didn't retreat.
I thought you were the dark, wild rebel who leads maidens into unspeakable acts in moonlit groves.
That sounds like me, he agreed, but only if one of the aforementioned maidens is my wife.
Mira's words came back to me. The Alansans do have morals.
Of course. Some do. Some don't.
That, and I want to maintain something honorable and, I don't know, exalted with you.
I want that too.
I moved closer again. But I also want to kiss you now.
Cedric shook his head. You don't make it easy.
But then you never have.
He leaned down and cupped my face, kissing me without any more fear or hesitation. There was only the scantest breath of distance between us, a distance I knew we were both acutely aware of and struggling to maintain. Despite my bold words, I found myself shaking. I no longer felt cold in the water. I had that sense I always did with him, that the two of us were standing on some kind of precipice, always on the verge of some drastic outcome. I knew if I closed the space between us and wrapped myself in him, all his honorable and exalted intentions would fall away, probably landing right beside my fine words about going to my wedding bed a virgin. But we didn't close that distance. When we finally managed to part, we were both breathless and aching, starving for something we couldn't have. Long, tension-filled moments hung between us as our gazes locked, and we both tried to gain some control of ourselves.
I think, said Cedric, tucking a wet lock of hair behind my ear, we should get married sooner rather than later.
I agree. I was still reeling, still heady from how tantalizingly close he was. I took a few steps back, just to be safe, and then gestured around us. But in the meantime, if we don't have anything better to do, well, do you want to go pan some gold and strike it rich?
Chapter 24.
We did not, as it turned out, strike it rich that day, or the next day. And soon, one day merged into another as we settled into a routine. Cedric was up at sunrise each morning to make the 2-hour trip to the Marshalls. He'd bring me back to his claim and I'd help him until late afternoon. Then it was another ride back to have dinner with the family. Cedric would return to his claim and I'd tutor the children until we went to bed. I had no trouble falling asleep anymore. I felt especially bad for Cedric. He spent half his day bringing me back and forth, but he said he liked having me around, and a lot of tasks went more smoothly with 2 sets of hands. Every little bit helped. And really, we were just dealing with little bits. Panning for gold wasn't that difficult once I got the knack of it. The river was wide and shallow in some places, and it was a simple matter to wade out and sit on a rock. I could pan all day, and end up with a handful of tiny glittering gold pieces. Dust, really. A handful each day wasn't going to pay out what we owed Warren. Certainly not in a month.
It adds up, Cedric told me near the end of one day.
I eyed our carefully protected hoard of gold dust.
Will it be enough?
It's worth more than you think.
I mean, I'm sure back in Osfro your servants swept up and threw out this much gold dust every day from your house. But in the real world, this is a lot of money.
It was enough money, in fact, that Cedric announced he was going to take a trip into White Rock and spend it on something called a sluice.
You're going to spend what little we have, I asked. Or are you using credit?
That would have been worse. I didn't want to owe Warren any more than we did. Cedric shook his head. He didn't shave very often these days, and an auburn shadow covered his lower face. I didn't mind it, though it made for itchy kissing.
We've got enough in the gold we've panned so far to get what I need.
All that work gone.
The very thought made me weary, considering how many hours I'd spent standing in the river. Both of us had toughened up considerably in the last couple of weeks. I had calluses on my hands. And when I'd finally found a mirror, I'd discovered the hat had done only so much to keep the sun off me, as I'd feared.
"It'll be worth it to get what I need," Cedric said. "Sluices sit in the river and essentially pan for us. We can get more gold in less time."
"That's promising," I admitted. "But sometimes I feel like this claim has just enough gold to give us false hope, but not enough to pay out. And I think Warren knew that."
"There's a very real possibility of that." Cedric's face started to fall, but then his optimism quickly returned. "But we're not going to make that call until we've exhausted all our options. If he expects us to give up at the first sign of trouble, he's in for a surprise."
So I spent the next day helping around the homestead. There was never any end to the chores needing to be done, something I thought about quite a bit. If Cedric and I were able to settle in Westhaven, life wouldn't be very different than in Haddison. We'd be living on the frontier, in modest accommodations. There'd be no servants to help. When I'd come to Blue Spring Manor, I'd been naive about the labor ordinary people did. Now I was rapidly becoming proficient in all sorts of tasks I'd never imagined. I also found that all of my fancy education meant little to my students. These were children who'd grown up without a school of any kind, and had been sent to work early. The things I taught them were basic, reading and simple arithmetic. It gave me a new understanding of the world and the variety of people who lived within it. These thoughts were on my mind when Cedric came for me the day after his White Rock trip. Noticing my thoughtfulness as we rode on old Lizzie, he asked me about it. "It's hard out here. Harder than I ever imagined," I said, trying to explain. "But I don't always mind. I'm coming to love this land. I like the quietness, the openness. And I like the way people have come to better themselves, and not in the way the glittering court bettered us. It's hard to explain. But I realize the common people out here aren't going to be common forever. It's all survival now, but one day, arts and education could flourish here like they have in Ostro, and I'm excited to be a part of it." He leaned forward to kiss me lightly on the neck. "It'll be even better in Westhaven. The determination they show here is a great thing, but it's even greater when paired with the freedom of thought and belief Westhaven will have. Mind and body have to survive out here." "Oh," he shifted around behind me, reaching into his pocket. "I picked up a letter for you while I was in town." I read it as I rode. It was from Tamsin. "Dear Adelaide, they tell me you can get letters out there, but I'm skeptical. I hope this actually reaches you and doesn't get eaten by a bear. Life here is beautiful. I've gone to a different party every night. There have been a few gentlemen with potential, but I'm still holding out for Warren. His position, both in finances and in power, is exactly what I need. Plus, I'll be nearer to you. Now if I could just get him to fall hopelessly madly in love with me, things would be perfect. It's a good sign that he told me to wait for him, but I could use a little bit more. Some of the Grashon settlers are still hanging around, and I wish they would go. I'm tired of seeing them. The only upside of them being here is that it reminds me how nice it is to wear colour again. Mira's been behaving very strangely. Did she do that while you were here? The last couple of days in particular she's been off, sometimes distracted, sometimes irritable. Since she's always been the least moody out of all of us, you can imagine how weird that is. I found out she's only received one legitimate offer. Did you know that? I guess plenty of men like to dance with her and talk to her, but they leave it at that. The offer is from some ancient plantation owner, and I do mean ancient. He's at least 80. I suppose that would make me irritable too. But it's a very respectable position. He's well situated, and she'd have a lot of control of the house, which I think she'd like. And since he is so old, I don't think he'd ask much of her, if you know what I mean. I wish I could write more, but that would take time away from doing my hair for tonight's party. It's at a shipping magnate's home. He's not as good a catch as Warren, but he's a solid backup, just in case. I don't know how you could have given this up for digging in the dirt all day, but I hope you are happy and well. All my love, Tamsin." I smiled as I folded up the letter. I could practically hear every word of it coming from Tamsin's mouth. "She's always writing letters," I told Cedric. "It's nice to finally get one of my own." The day was already heating up when we reached the claim, but I hardly noticed any more. I worked in rolled-up sleeves and a split skirt of light cotton, that Mistress Marshall had helped me make, since the suede one was too worn these days. I'd done a lot of the sewing myself, and while my stitches still weren't great, they were significantly improved. Also improved was our efficiency once the sluices were set up. A sluice was a wide box that water could run through, filtering through a screen that trapped heavy minerals, ideally gold. We decided on a few good spots in the river and placed them there, watching for several minutes as though we expected huge gold boulders to immediately get trapped. "Not an instant gold strike," I said, "but faster than panning." Cedric handed me my pan.
"Which we still have to do."
We'd been out panning in the river for a couple of hours when we heard a voice call.
"Thorn, are you here?"
We looked up. Several riders were cutting across the claim and waved their hands in greeting. Cedric waved back and began wading through the water toward them. I followed close behind.
"Who are they?"
"Alonzans. I saw them in town the other day. They just finalized the paperwork on a claim on the far edge of Hatterson. Far by design. I know a cousin of theirs. He was one of the Alonzans arrested at the Star Advent that later managed to escape. He's waiting for them at that claim, and I told them to stop by when they made their trip out." Although I'd grown used to the idea of Cedric as an Alonzan, I'd yet to truly meet any others. This group looked perfectly ordinary, not much different from the Marshall clan. They wore rough working-class clothes and hauled a wagon loaded with supplies. Cedric introduced them as the Galvestons, consisting of a middle-aged couple and their four children. Their oldest son was married and had his pregnant wife with them. No sordid rituals or prayers followed. The Galvestons had been traveling that day and appreciated the break, especially from the younger children who ran off to play. We sat with the adults and shared our water, mostly trading news. After a few weeks in Hatterson, Cedric and I felt like veterans and offered what expertise we had. The elder Mr. Galveston, named Francis, proved to have more expertise as he surveyed the shanty.
"Why don't you have anything to seal this roof?" he asked.
"There's wood there."
"I nailed the boards in myself." Cedric's pride in that feat was obvious, and I couldn't help smiling. I'd been there that day, and he'd hit his fingers with the hammer at least half a dozen times.
"And it's going to let in a deluge as soon as this place gets one of its famous storms. You need to get some canvas to cover the gaps."
"We got the last of it from the supplier in town. You'll have to wait until his new shipment comes in, or head back to Cape Triumph."
"I don't think we'll be back there anytime soon," Cedric said. "I'll have to take my chances with the rain."
Francis gestured for his older son and Cedric to follow.
"We might be able to do some patches. Let's take a look."
That left me sitting with the women in the grass. Alice, the daughter-in-law, stretched and rested a hand on her swelling belly.
"Are you uncomfortable?" I asked. "Can I get you anything?"
"No, thank you."
She shared a knowing smile with her mother-in-law, Henrietta.
"When we read my destiny card at the beginning of the pregnancy, I drew the Keeper of Roses."
When they saw my blank look, Henrietta asked,
"Aren't you familiar with the card?"
"I'm not familiar with any of the cards," I admitted.
I realized they were talking about the Dianzen cards, like the pack Ada had had. Ordinary people use them for games and fortune-telling. For the Alonzans, the cards had a more sacred meaning and were holy to Dianziel, the moon angel who governed inner wisdom. Alice's frown smoothed out, but her confusion remained.
"When Cedric introduced you as his fiancée, I just assumed..."
"That I was Alonzan," I finished. Both looked embarrassed, and then Alice asked,
"Are you going to convert after you're married?"
"I hadn't planned on it."
"Then why go to the trouble of raising money for Westhaven now?" asked Henrietta.
The Galvestons would have liked to go there as well, but were waiting until the colony was more settled and required no charter fees. They hoped to earn money in gold in the meantime. "For Cedric, I want him to be able to practice safely, and he's very interested in taking up a leadership role there," I explained. "Being a charter member would help with that." Awkward silence fell, and I tried to fill it when it was clear they wouldn't.
"So, what does the Keeper of Roses mean?"
For a moment, I didn't think they'd tell me.
"It shows a man who works hard in his garden, protecting delicate flowers against harsh conditions. He's ultimately rewarded with beautiful blooms," said Henrietta.
I turned to Alice.
"So for you, it's symbolic of the pregnancy. You're going through a lot of tough times now, facing a lot of hardships on this journey, but your baby will be born healthy and strong, ultimately flourishing as the roses do."
I'd hope the card's message could be extrapolated to your family's all-around prosperity in Haddison. Both women stared at me in astonishment.
Was I close?
I asked.
Yes, said Henrietta at last. Something like that.
Her eyes lifted beyond me.
Glenn, get down from there before you break your neck.
The two young Galveston daughters were splashing in shallow water, but the younger son was trying to climb some of the rocky outcroppings that marked the beginning of the foothills and mountains. He wasn't going to get very high free-handed, but I could understand her concern. He didn't seem to hear. I'll go get him, I said. I rose, both wanting to be helpful and get away from the stairs. Glenn had made impressive progress getting up, which only meant he was in more danger if he slipped and fell.
Glenn, I said, your mother wants you. It's too dangerous up there.
He didn't even look at me.
Just a minute. I've almost got another one.
Another what? He stretched his arm up to a small jutting of stone and whooped triumphantly. Then he scrabbled down like some kind of rock lizard. The front of his overalls had a huge pocket that was filled with rocks. He slipped his shiny new find in with the rest. I beckoned him back toward his family.
Isn't that heavy to carry around? It's for my collection. I've got dozens more. Did you know there are people, special smart people, back in Osford who study rocks all the time?
I do know that. They're called geologists.
Geologists.
He said the word like he was tasting it. The king commissions them to travel and learn new things about rocks and minerals.
I'd like to do that. But once we've got enough gold for a farm, they say I'll have to help work it.
I patted his head.
Never assume you'll have to follow the destiny someone else has planned out for you.
And I'll show you some other neat rocks. I walked him over to the shaded pond where I'd previously noticed some small mottled pebbles. Glenn was fascinated and I left him to it, figuring he couldn't get in much trouble. As I approached the others from the back of the shanty, I overheard Henrietta speaking to Cedric.
Not my place, but are you sure that's the best idea?
Of course it is, said Cedric. I love her.
That's fine and well, but you're letting yourself get charmed by a pretty face. Once you're out of bed, you'll see the real consequences.
What are you going to do when you have children?
I hope you're at least going to make her convert.
No one makes her do anything. As for children, here Cedric hesitated. Well, we'll get around to discussing it.
You'd better discuss it now, said Francis. It's a serious matter. You're an educated man with a business background. Exactly the kind the Alonzans need to go forward and build respectability for the future. Founding West Haven is the right way to do this. But how will it look if your own wife isn't a member of the faith?
It'll look like she has her own opinions and goes with them. Just as we've been telling the Orthodox we have the right to do. And the point of West Haven is to welcome people of all beliefs, Alonzan or otherwise. The Galvestons weren't convinced, and Alice finally concluded with,
Well, there's a magistrate in White Rock who's one of us. You should seek his counsel before you do something stupid. She's a threat to your faith and a threat to our success.
When I rejoined them, they all tried to act like nothing had happened, but didn't do a very good job. It was time to wrap up their visit anyway, and we were all a little relieved.
Oh, Glenn, exclaimed Henrietta when she saw his bulging pocket of stones. What did I tell you about those rocks? They're for my collection, he stated. I'm going to be a royal geologist. A what? Never mind, we aren't going to keep hauling rocks around. Leave those here.
Glenn obstinately stuck out his lower lip, and I quickly knelt down before him. It is a lot to carry around. Why don't you leave them here? I'll keep them safe until you're able to come back for them. He didn't look as though he liked that idea, but he also didn't like crossing his mother. So the rocks were left in a small pile by the shanty, and we waved the Galvestons off.
Don't say it, Cedric said as soon as they were gone. I know you overheard, and you just need to forget about it.
It's kind of hard to forget being called a threat to you, or hearing that our marriage would be something stupid.
No religion is truly enlightened. There are closed-minded people in all of them.
I looked him in the eye.
What are we going to do when we have children?
Marvel at their perfection?
Cedric, take things seriously for once. His smile faded. I am. And as for kids, I don't know. We'll teach them my beliefs and whatever it is you believe, which I still don't really know. And they can make their own decisions.
I don't think your Alonzan friends will like that.
It was strange. There'd been so many complications in our relationship. The scandal of it even existing, our money troubles, the danger surrounding him. But never had I imagined that I'd be the complication in his life. I haven't gone through all this, given up so much, just for you to get out of bed one morning and realize you made a mistake.
In that scenario, the only mistake would have been leaving your bed in the first place.
He took my hands and pulled me to him. In all seriousness, this issue, our difference of belief, isn't one that's taken me by surprise. I knew from the instant I fell for you that we'd have this looming beside us. Beside us, not between us. We will deal with it, and we will overcome it, just like we have everything else. I closed my eyes briefly and then sighed. I just wish there wasn't so much we had to keep overcoming. Probably when it's all over, we'll just be bored. The two of us? Never. We kissed, and he pressed me up against the side of the shanty. Somehow the argument had made me want him even more, and heat shot through me at the feel of his body on mine. One of his hands tangled in my hair, and the other played dangerously with the edge of my skirt, pushing it up my leg. "Be careful," I said, unable to resist. "I don't think this shanty wall can withstand very much." He pulled back, his breathing rapid and eyes hungry as they looked me over. Not hungry, ravenous. Now who doesn't take things seriously? "Hey, it's a credit to your prowess that I'd even think..." I lost track of what I was saying as a flash of sunlight caught my eye. I pushed Cedric aside, confusing him even more, and knelt down to where I'd seen the sparkle. It was in Glenn's rock pile. Sifting through them, I found one that glittered golden in the sunlight. I held it up for Cedric to see. "Is it real?" I asked. We'd heard plenty of stories in White Rock about prospectors being deceived by lookalikes. Cedric got down beside me and held the rock up. It was only a pebble, but it was solid gold.
"It's real,"
he confirmed.
"Where did this come from?"
"The future royal geologist found it over by the outcroppings, heading toward the foothills. I saw it shining but thought it was some kind of crystal." We walked to the far side of the claim, opposite the river. The sparse vegetation thinned out even more here as the rocky land took hold. I pointed to the base of the outcropping in question. It was no mountain, but the large formation was still high enough to make me uneasy when I thought of how high Glenn had gotten. And that wasn't even near the top. Cedric stared up at it for a long moment.
"You need to meet my neighbor, Sully.
Nice old guy. He's helped me figure a few things out. His claim has some rock formations like this, and he said he nearly ground them to dust looking for gold. Apparently there was some early Haddison explorer who found big deposits of gold in things like these. Massive deposits. Larger than anything gleaned from the river." I followed his gaze and let those words sink in.
"How would you be able to find out? Just start chipping through?"
"Kind of. Look, there's a crevasse at the top. Digging into it might show something, if I can get up there." "Get up there?" I stared at the tallest cliff. "That's pretty high. I'll need some equipment to climb up and check."
"Come on, Adelaide," he added, seeing my face. "It's safe with the right gear.
And if there is a deposit in there, we're set."
"Where are you going to get that equipment?"
He held up the pebble. "This'll buy what I need for the initial inspection. If there is gold in there, that's going to be a much more serious excavation. One we'll need to talk to Warren and Elias about. We might need to talk to them anyway. The sooner we can move on this, the better." The smile on his face was radiant as he looked back at me. The sunlight lit up his tanned features, turning his auburn hair molten. He looked like some sort of ardent young god, a dirty one. But despite all the doubts I had in the world, I believed in him.
"Adelaide," he told me,
"you might just be married in silk after all."
Chapter 25. I stayed back with the Marshalls the next day, while Cedric went to buy the climbing gear. It was hard to hide my excitement as I helped with the chores, but I couldn't risk tipping my hand yet.
"Well, you're in a good mood," Mistress Marshall remarked. "Haven't complained once about the lie. Just have other things on my mind, that's all. Getting use out of the cinnamon thorn, eh? That's the only thing that could give you a smile that big."
"Haven't even touched it," I said. She obviously didn't believe me. When Cedric took me out on the claim the next day, I barely waited until we'd cleared the Marshall property. Did you get the gear?
Yes and no. The supply store had only some of the things I needed, and then I ran into Elias Carter. Wonderful. Is he smiling yet? No, especially when he found out what I was there for. He's skeptical about a deposit in the cliffs and says I'm just stirring up trouble. If there really is a substantial amount there, we'd have to bring in more laborers, and there are a lot of men in town jumping at the chance for extra work. I could picture Elias delivering all of that in his condescending tone. So what? He's not going to let you do it? I can survey it, but he wants to see it himself, at least from a distance. He's supposed to come out today and bring some climbing gear from another supplier in town that was closed yesterday. He made it clear, of course, that it was a terrible inconvenience for him. Of course, I sighed. And here I thought this was going to be a nice day. It was a nice day. The work was so second nature now that I could do it automatically and spend time talking with Cedric. We talked about the future, what we'd do in Westhaven, what we'd name our children with their yet-to-be-determined religious futures. The happy mood evaporated when Elias rode up with a few cronies in tow.
"No ball gown today, huh?" he asked. "From a distance, I wouldn't even think you're a woman at all."
"Do you have the gear?" Cedric asked pointedly. Elias nodded to one of his men, who threw down a pile of ropes and spikes.
"The gold you left didn't entirely cover it. We'll be adding it to your account."
Cedric managed a tight smile. "Of course." Elias gestured impatiently.
"Well then, let's see this fortune you think you found. I don't have all day."
We went to the far side of the claim opposite the river. The sparse vegetation thinned out even more here as the rocky land took hold. Cedric pointed to the base of the outcropping in question. It was no mountain, but it was still high enough to make me uneasy. The jagged, uneven surface was equally disconcerting.
"Sully says this is just what Davis Mitchell had on his claim when he made his big strike," Cedric said.
Elias squinted up.
"Sully? You mean George Sullivan? I'd hardly consider him an expert. He's been out here a year with no luck."
"But he knew Davis Mitchell," Cedric pointed out, "and saw his claim."
Davis Mitchell was a legendary figure in Haddison. He'd made a huge fortune in gold and eventually returned to Osfro to live on his earnings. If there was even a remote chance this might yield the same, it had to be investigated. "And," added Cedric, "this is the edge of my property. If there's gold here..."
"Mr. Doyle's property," corrected Elias. "You only work it."
Cedric was undaunted.
"If there's gold here, it's likely part of a vein that runs up through those foothills and into that mountain stretch. Those don't have any leases, right? Mr. Doyle could hire workers directly and wouldn't have to split it with the claim holder."
"No end of trouble to mine those mountains," grumbled Elias,
but I could see the gleam in his eyes as he contemplated the possibility.
"Fine, climb that beast and see what's up there. Report your findings to me immediately. If there's anything worthwhile there, Mr. Doyle will help make arrangements for a proper extraction when he returns from Cape Triumph. And don't start spreading rumors until you're absolutely sure what it's holding."
"Of course," Cedric said, again keeping his tone polite in spite of Elias's snide tone. An awkward silence fell between us all, and then Elias said,
"Well, aren't you going to invite us into your home for some refreshment? We came all this way to help you."
I flinched, remembering that Cedric had an Alanzan diamond on the wall.
"It's so cramped in there," I said. "Hardly any room between the bed and the stove. I'll go bring you something, and you can enjoy it out here on this beautiful day."
Elias eyed me askance.
"How kind of you. And how fortunate you're so familiar with the shanty and its bed."
I smiled sweetly. "I'll be right back." I walked away calmly, like some dutiful young lady serving the menfolk. Once inside Cedric's shanty, I hastily closed the door and performed a frantic search. I pulled the diamond down and shoved it in a trunk he'd brought from Cape Triumph. It held a pack of Jansen cards, though they at least were at the bottom of the trunk. I wrapped them in a shirt to make them harder to find and deemed the house safe should anyone come in. Refreshment options were meager, as Elias no doubt knew. This was a power play. I'd seen canteens on their horses, and he and his men probably had snacks far better than anything we could muster. Cedric's stove was quirky at best, which was why Mistress Marshall's food always seemed so indulgent to him.
I wrapped up some cornbread that she'd given Cedric and brought it outside with cups and a pitcher of water. The water had come from a